Markets might just be shedding their pessimism. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio. Markets are looking up, and are way up, compared with the start of the first quarter back in January. The S&P 500, for example, is up 15% since the start of January. Jeffrey Cleveland is chief economist at Payden & Riegel. Good morning.
Good morning.
So you've said the pessimism with which markets entered this first quarter of 2019 was overdone. Why is that?
There's been a lot of concern, not only about slower U.S. growth, but slower European growth and a global slowdown. But I think perhaps we're getting news that the first quarter wasn't as bad as everyone thought. And so that has a tendency to make investors upgrade their narratives.
The head of the IMF over the weekend said that the global economy is in a delicate position. This was after they downgraded their current estimates for growth in 2018 and also said that things would pick up at the end of the year. Would you not agree?
We've seen global data slow over the last 6 to 9 months, and I think the IMF's economic growth forecast has followed that monthly PMI data. But in the last couple of weeks, we've actually seen better services PMI readings out of Europe in places like Italy and Spain. And so we're seeing hints that perhaps the global economy is bottoming and will pick up over the rest of the year.
Jeffrey Cleveland, chief economist with Payden & Riegel. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
We got U.S. industrial production data out just a few moments ago. This is a measure of industrial output in the U.S. It fell 0.1% in March, but had been expected to rise slightly. Still, it's up about 3% from last year. And with that, let us do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 140 points. That is 0.5%. The S&P 500 is up 0.3%. The NASDAQ also up 0.3%. And the 10-year Treasury yield is at 2.57%. Bank of America reported a better-than-expected rise in quarterly profit this morning. The bank said loans to consumers rose 3% and loans to businesses rose 4% in the first quarter. That plus cost-cutting, the bank said, made up for a drop in revenue from investment banking. It has been a rough decade for shopping malls. They don't call it the retail apocalypse for nothing. Department stores lost almost 500,000 jobs between 2002 and 2017, for example. Some malls have tried hard to lure customers off their phones and computers and into shopping centers by offering what's known as experiential shopping. Well, bad news. That strategy doesn't seem to be working all that well. Marketplace's Ben Bradford has more.
The Grove in Los Angeles is the kind of shopping center that draws street performers and tourists.
We've heard of it?
I heard of it from Extra. I think they used to film here or whatever.
Thomas Vodnik and Jenny Casaus stopped by on a trip from New Mexico to visit a reality TV star's jewelry store.
We're going to Kristen Cavallari's pop-up shop.
Malls used to rely on huge department stores, but they're struggling. So many malls are now trying to be more like The Grove, drawing customers with experiences, particularly high-end interactive shops like Apple stores and Italian marketplace Eataly. So how's that strategy working?
The data suggests it's not.
John Collins with data analytics firm Thasos has a new study that finds these malls aren't getting noticeably more visitors.
I think we may not have found the right mix of experiential tenants yet, however.
He suggests the typical shopping mall may have to do more. After all, most still lack The Grove's trolley and dancing fountain. I'm Ben Bradford for Marketplace.
James in Bridgewater, New Jersey, wrote to express his appreciation for the way that Marketplace presents business and economic news at the everyman and everywoman level and offers insights not provided by other news outlets. Now, if you agree with James, please join him as a Marketplace investor by donating online at marketplace.org. Thanks to James and everyone who makes our work possible.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
Hooch. Ruckus juice, white lightning, tiger spit, moonshine has many names. It is known for being strong and illegal in days gone by, but today distillers are making it legally, and Irina Jorov reports that marketing it can get personal.
Brian Call is a seventh-generation distiller. He makes his moonshine, totally legally, in a warehouse in Wilkesboro, North Carolina. It's open to the public. A family recipe of moonshine starter fizzes in huge wooden vats. They look like 1,000-gallon hot tubs.
So what's in here?
We got cornmeal, barley malt, cracked wheat, and a little bit of sugar.
And that's what your dad would use?
Yep, that's what he done when he made moonshine.
His dad was a bootlegger. He made hooch in the woods.
There wasn't a lot of jobs around here in Wilkes County.
His dad's story is as important as the recipe. And that's true for a lot of legal moonshine producers.
The packaging and selling of moonshine really depends upon a selling of a kind of a narrative.
Author Matt Bondurant wrote The Wettest County in the World about his own family's moonshining past.
A rebellious outlaw, distinctly Southern figure.
Bondurant says the narrative is especially important because moonshine is not likely to impress you when you first taste it.
What you've got is just an extremely high content corn whiskey with a very sort of flat flavor profile. It smells just like rotten corn, and it'll burn you all the way down. There's not a whole lot going for it.
In the past decade, the number of moonshine brands and flavors has grown rapidly. Nationwide, the amount of shine sold is about 16 times what it was a decade ago. You see it lined up on store shelves, often in old-timey square mason jars or jugs with little handles and labels printed with ramshackle homesteads. On the Call family label, the patriarch's face looks back at you. Brian Call's wife, Laura, takes it a step further. She tells his story during moonshine tastings.
They love having a family member give them a tour and talk about it.
She's hung up her father-in-law's overalls by the entrance and parked the handsome cars he hauled shine in out back.
To see the actual moonshine cars is very thrilling for people. Because, you know, moonshine, even when people still sip the moonshine, it's almost like we're doing something we shouldn't be doing.
Visitors can also take their own mugshots with a backdrop she printed. As the moonshine market matures, some brands have corporate backing and celebrity sponsors. Call says what her distillery has is a real story of humble family members that ran moonshine to make ends meet. I'm Irina Jorov for Marketplace.
That story first aired on The Gravy Podcast, a production of the Southern Foodways Alliance. I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.